This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest played a role in a part of history that was popularized by the book and movie Exodus. After World War II, many Jewish Holocaust survivors in Europe had no place to go and ended up in overcrowded camps for displaced persons. Israel didn't yet exist. At the time, Palestine was under British rule, and the British had strict limitations on immigration. The British had a naval blockade to prevent refugees from entering Palestine. But the Haganah tried to break the blockade with dozens of boats carrying thousands of Jewish refugees seeking sanctuary. The Haganah was the underground military of the Jews of Palestine. Rudolf Patzert had worked in the Merchant Marines during World War II. In 1947, he became the captain of the Paducah, whose clandestine mission was to smuggle nearly 1,500 Jewish refugees from Bulgaria into Palestine. His commander was Moke Lyman of the Haganah. His ship was a small, run-down, converted gunboat. I asked Captain Patzert if he believed all his passengers would fit.
I didn't think so, but the Haganah people, Moke said, we've been doing this, and it'll have to fit. Well, I said, it's pretty dangerous. Well, he said, if you knew the conditions of the camps and how they were living, if they didn't have the possibility to make this trip, why, thousands of other ones would lose faith, too, because it was the only hope they had to get out of Europe and out of the camps, these little ships. So he said he would show me how they could load it all.
So you had to squeeze a lot of people in. People probably came with whatever belongings they had left in the world. How did you board them onto the ship? Maybe you could describe what that night was like.
It was dark. We had a cone of lights, cluster lights, onto the gangways. We had four gangways out to our ship. And it was a quiet. I still remember the quiet. You could hear the sounds of the water draining from the ship's discharges and all. Then the first ones came into view. And they were very small children. And it was the orphans that came first. 4, 5, 6, 7-year-olds, barely able to walk, some of them. And had all different kinds of clothing. They had a bundle, like little bundles. They were as wide as they were tall. Old caps and old hats over their heads. And these kids come up. And when he came up to the gangway, I had my sailors there. And the sailors, it was a very emotional thing. They would grab the kids who had trouble walking up the little gangway. And they would carry them into the ship. And take him into the special bunks. Everything was prepared on the ship for the small children. We parted to keep him as close to the deck as possible, where we get fresh air and perhaps a little sunshine when we are out at sea.
What kind of condition were the adults in when they boarded?
The kids were, like I described, and after the first tiny ones was about the teenagers, 12, 14-year-olds, and these in Cyprus. Not in Cyprus, but in the camps they'd been in Europe, where they'd been taught songs, been able to do things to take care of themselves. So these kids were inspiring. They came down the dock singing Hatikva. It was the first time I'd heard that the Jewish song of hope. And then there was some older people. We had mostly children, orphans, and some older people. And these all trudged along, come up. It was a terrible sight of their conditions. Battered and all, not physically, but from hunger and from depression, and there was things of the war done to them. And then we saw a little gang of very tough kids, 18, 19, 20-year-olds. I asked Namoka, who are these kids? He said, these are our wild kids. They got escaped from camps, and they survived in Europe, in a very bad Europe there. They robbed and did very rough things there to keep alive. And it was sort of cynical of us, too, then, at this stage. So what Moke did, is my Haganah commander, well, he gave him responsibilities. I still remember when he looked at him, the way they looked back at him, a little bit contemptuous, questioning where his authority was and all. But they worked out very well.
Do you think that the Jewish people who boarded your ship had any idea of how likely it was that the ship was going to be captured?
I think they expected anything, and it was in the news about the British campaign and the British Navy, so they had a good idea that perhaps they would end up in another camp, which is what happened.
What were your plans about what you were going to do if you were captured?
It was funny. If you know that you're going to be captured, you look over the charts and figure, what can you do about it? And we knew that we would end up on Cyprus. So I was looking at that map of Cyprus, seeing how far it was from the nearest land. Was any place on the island itself we could escape to? The little knowledge we had. And really, I just really accepted the fact that I would be captured and be put in a camp on Cyprus.
How were you captured?
We were about 12 miles off the coast of Haifa, and the British had four destroyers then, big ones, and they had been prepared. They had built the pipe structure, the platforms that were higher than our rails. So Mocha, he got angry there because we had been orders not to resist because we had so many old people and children. And he was angry because he wanted to resist. The Haganah all through on the fight on every occasion, no more supinely giving in passively. So he said, let's go down the coast a little ways. So I told the wheelsman, all right, parallel the coast, turn and give it, change your different course, and we'll go and see what happens. So we were outside the 12-mile limit, but the British were not for caring about niceties, so the destroyers charged. I heard Sholo and the bosun say, here they come, and they hit us. They charged us, rammed us from two sides. And when they rammed into us, and the ship was shaking and rolling, while the paratroopers dropped from these platforms onto our deck. And I saw some sailors shooting hoses at us. I thought it was going to be high-pressure water, but it was tear gas. So they took care of it. We didn't fight. They took over the ship very quickly. And we knew that the Exodus and the previous ships had been captured. The British had sailed them back to Germany, where they made the Germans take the people there. So we figured we're not going to let them do it with this ship. So I'd ordered the engineers. As soon as the destroyers hit us, to dismantle the engines, our engines, so they couldn't be used again. Use welders' torches and all, cut port lines, and they did that. So we were dead in the water, and the British took us over.
When the British took over your ship, you pretended that you were a Jewish refugee instead of an American captain of this ship. So you took a Jewish name, you changed into refugee clothes, you pretended you didn't speak English. Why did you pretend to be one of the Jews? What was the thinking behind that?
It was a camouflage. We didn't want the British to identify us and select us and arrest us. So we mixed with the people so they couldn't find us.
How would you have been punished if they knew you were the captain?
Well, they were talking in that time. British were trying to get the Americans to prosecute American captains who were doing this and give them 4 or 5 years in the penitentiary to punish them.
My guest is Captain Rudolf Patzert. He's written a memoir called Running the Palestine Blockade. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Captain Rudolf Patzert, author of the new memoir, Running the Palestine Blockade. So you ended up spending 2 years in a detention camp with the Jewish refugees who were on your ship. This was a refugee camp in Cyprus that had been built for German prisoners of war. What was the camp like?
The camp was terrible. It was barbed wires, had the watchtowers, and the British soldiers were not bad, except that they were bored to death. It was a terrible job they had there. And they were anti-Semitic. They blamed the Jews for this position. The food was terrible. The vegetables that came in were pretty rotten at that stage. And the camps were surrounded by latrines, so you were never outside the smell of the latrines. And the condition of the people were bad when they came in. After all these camps they'd been through, and the fact that they were survivors, to go into another camp when they'd been so close to Palestine, it was an added blow to them. It really knocked them out. And so we were there about 3 months, and then the Haganah wanted to get us out. The British, under the white paper, allowed 750 people a month to go proceed to Palestine legally. They would give them a certificate. So what the Haganah did was they had some people who were there, had been there for a year or 2 years, surrender their passport that the British had given to the sailors. So I took on a different name then, and I took this old man's passport. And the way they had moved us,
Let me just explain here. The Haganah wanted the crew to be able to get to Palestine. So the Haganah asked some of the people who were eligible as refugees to actually get there. They asked them to give you their passports.
Right.
After you were able to go to Palestine, your adventure actually continued. You were told that you would be taken first by the British to a Haifa prison camp, and then after about 2 months, you would be interrogated before you were released. Now, let's remember you were still passing here as a Jewish refugee. So if they interrogated you as a Jewish refugee, you might have had a hard time
exactly
figuring out what to tell them. So you knew you'd be better off if you escaped.
Right.
And you managed to escape.
I did.
How did you do it?
Well, what happened was, Boca was taught by buddy there, he said, prepare yourself. Now you're going to get rid of all the foreign Polish and Romanian clothes. We'll give you Palestinian clothes, short khaki pants, khaki shirt. And if there's any opportunity, when this ship unloads at the docks at Haifa, well, you make a break for it. Try to escape. So we were headed outside of Haifa, and we were in the air part of town when I saw my bus driver, an old man. He ran the bus into the bus ahead real hard. Then he threw open the doors, and he said in German, geht weg, you know, scram. So I took off right away, and the rest of us did, and had three members of my crew who were with me. But I figured I would get outside their lines, the British lines, and try to control the situation, and I did. And I met one of my second mate who was a little further up ahead of me. And so we kept walking into town, into the Jewish part of town, and the way we got picked up, when I went into a little Jewish watchmaker's place, and I told him in English, we just escaped the British, and we have to get off the streets right away. So he didn't say a word. He put his hat down, took the loop out of his eye, and took us down the street to the community center. And he took us up there, and they took care of us right away. They gave us a sandwich, gave us a glass of milk. They made a telephone call. And about 10 minutes, a big car came with Haganah men in it. So they picked us up and took us to one of the finest big hotels in Haifa. It was owned by the trade union movement, the History of Druze. And they put us there. And in about an hour, they took us out, took us to a clothing store, outfitted us in clothes, had our pictures taken for new passports, and a different name again. So that's the way we were picked up.
Do you know if any of the people who were on board your ship and then were detained by the British ever made it to Palestine?
Oh, they did. The camps were opened a year and a half after the British left. They still kept them in the camps in Palestine. Then the camps were opened, and the Jews had us, Palestinians, now the Israelis, had to transport them. But they all arrived in Palestine, everybody.
Did any of the ships trying to get to Palestine actually make it through?
Earlier, small ships, quite a number of them, ran up on the beach at night. They would follow the coast around, and the British didn't have the amount of navy there to keep the surveillance. And they did make it. They would run up on the beach. The people would jump into the water. Then people from shore would pick them up in trucks and cars and motorcycles and disperse them around the countryside and into kibbutz and into the cities. But at our stage of the game, it was after the Exodus, the big battle of the Exodus, and the 10 American ships. There were 10 American ships that brought in around 60,000 people. At that stage, while the Navy had everything closed down.
I'm curious if you ever saw the movie Exodus.
Yeah, I saw that.
What'd you think of it?
I was very disappointed when I saw it. It was a romantic light, and I thought it would have some of the images that we had during the trip, the people as they actually were, the kind of villains that the British played. It was an old empire trying to hold on, and they played a very bad role. And it wasn't colorful. I know it's the Israelis liked it because it brought them a lot of support and all. But I really remember how my spirits dropped when I saw Exodus.
What are some of the images that stayed in your mind that you hoped to see in the movie and didn't?
Oh, the children, the condition of the children. And like on Cyprus, the people who were fighting among themselves, it was no nice cooperative thing. I remember they had high mortality rates among the mothers on Cyprus. So the Haganah tried to set some tin huts where they would be better protected against the weather, cold rain and winds and dust and dirt. And they set aside some tents, not tents, but tin huts for the mothers. So some people from the Exodus who'd been heroic and fought the British so hard, some Romanian Jews, they fought and took the huts away from the mothers. Stuff like this, people in this survival, it was a very rough deal, and this thing to stay alive.
Do you have any regrets that you participated in this, as it turns out, futile attempt to break the British blockade again and get to Palestine?
No, it's one of the great things of my life. It had been preceded by 4 years of war, where I spent in the North Atlantic and in the English Channel and the Mediterranean, where all sorts of tremendous things happened and all. But this was dimmed by this one voyage, by getting these people, giving them hope and participating in their struggle to get to Palestine. And it was amazing and very satisfying experience. I'm very close to all my crew still today.
Captain, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Captain Rudolf Patzert has written a new memoir called Running the Palestine Blockade. This is Fresh Air.